Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the historic Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another edition of From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. As we have been presenting our 1968 Revolution Rewind series, we have been listening to critical events from 40 years ago and the voices of the key figures during that time. This week, we listen to two visionary thinkers, both writers of the future, who have guided humanity by daring us to exercise our imagination. Ray Bradbury.
But I believe a great society is pulled up under great ideas. They can be poetic, they can be romantic, they can be many things, as long as they galvanize us.
And Gene Roddenberry.
Science fiction fans are the lousiest audience in the world. They think, which is heresy.
The American writer Ray Bradbury was born in 1920 in Waukegan, Illinois. After graduating from a Los Angeles high school in 1938, he began writing short stories for periodicals, subsequently publishing the first collection, Dark Carnival, in 1947. It wasn't until his chance meeting with writer Christopher Isherwood in 1950 that he got his big break. Isherwood passed along Bradbury's first novel, The Martian Chronicles, to a literary critic which advanced his career. Ray Bradbury would go on to write such classic works as Fahrenheit 451, The Illustrated Man, and Something Wicked This Way Comes. The 26th World Science Fiction Convention, also known as BayCon, was held August 29th through September 2nd in 1968 at the Hotel Claremont in Berkeley, California. Pacifica was there to record Ray Bradbury on the third day of the event.
I think I should tell you a true story to loosen you up. I think I'm glad to be alive at this hour of the day after last night. And I should tell you a true story to relax you about some adventures I had a few years ago. I don't know how many of you know, but I was put in charge of the United States Pavilion at the New York World's Fair back 5 years ago. It was a huge edifice. And the entire top of the United States Pavilion was as big as several football fields in size. And the government came to me and said, how would you like to fill the top of that pavilion with your ideas, which I thought was simply wonderful. I've been a great admirer of World's Fairs all my life. I went to the Chicago World's Fair when I was 12 and wandered around among the world of the future there, the Century of Progress exposition. I fell in love with the Hall of Science there. I went into the world of 1 million BC there. And I went home and built the whole exposition in my backyard out of cardboard and lit it with Christmas lights. I went to the first World Science Fiction Convention in 1939 in New York City and fell in love with the World's Fair there. And went home thinking, God, how wonderful someday to work on something like this, to be challenged to work on a building of this sort. So suddenly, 5 years ago, here's the government coming and saying, we want you to do a history of the United States in 17 minutes flat with a full symphony orchestra. Can you do it? I said, yes. I said, easiest thing in the world. Luckily, they came to me at a time in my life when I'd already had my encounters with Herman Melville, when I had met that great white whale and tried to render him down to some sort of oil that would light the motion picture lamps of the world.
Bradbury was the screenwriter for the 1956 adaptation of Melville's Moby Dick, directed by John Huston and starring Gregory Peck.
And I had reread during the last 10 years Jules Verne, one of my old true loves, deep loves. And so when it came time to write a 17-minute speech about a United States history and do it with a full symphony orchestra, I looked back to my old heroes. I went back to Melville. I went back to Jules Verne. And I said, how can you help me here at this time? What can you do to help me? And I knew I wanted to cover our 400-year history and then go into the future history of the American people. And I wanted to find a metaphor large enough to enclose us, Who are we? What are we? What were we? Where are we going with our dreams? What is our dream? What shapes us? What moves us? And so I came up with the idea of the triple wilderness. In other words, we are the wilderness people who came across a sea of water, the water wilderness, to come here. We are the people that crossed a wilderness of grass in order to stay here. And we are the people that moved toward a wilderness of stars in order to live forever. So once I got the idea of the triple wilderness, metaphor within metaphor within metaphor. And then suddenly Moby Dick loomed in my vision again, in the wilderness of the sea that we crossed. So the great shape of the whale I used at the top of the United States Pavilion, those of you who may have seen it, you got on a car with 40 other people. You moved in the darkness through this vast space, and you were surrounded by 110 screens of various sizes and shapes upon which the history of our country occurred to you, happened to you, as you moved in the darkness. So you made this gigantic circuit around the building. It's a super Disneyland ride, actually, is what we did. But with the Cinerama-sized screens, so that you, as Columbus, made the landfall of ancient America and got off finally on the land and crossed it, and all these things happened to you. But along the way there, Moby Dick happened to you. One of the great symbols is the symbol of the sea, the whale. Then the next symbol we come up with is the symbol of the submarine, which is the same shape and size as the whale. And the following symbol that I used to culminate the journey through the American wildernesses is the symbol of the rocket ship, which is the symbol of the submarine, which is the symbol of the whale. So each metaphor encloses the next. And when you have then visual images of this sort that people can take out of an exhibit, they can at the end of the journey say, yes, this is what we were, this is what we are, this is what we can be a million years from this afternoon. And I tried to put all of my dedication and excitement about writing science fiction all of my life and reading about it and being stirred by the rocket ship into this 17-minute prose poem. And at the very end, we go off a million years into space. And you come to the end of the ride, taking off among the stars and going on forever, because I think we are eternal people, with all that that means, with all the paradoxical elements, with all the destruction, with all the love, all the mixtures of things. I don't for a moment claim space travel is going to be the greatest love-making device and thing in the history of the world. I think we're going to go on being foolish, but I accept this. I think we're going to go on being violent and destructive. That's part of our past, it's part of our present, and it's going to be part of our future. Anyway, the ride worked. By the second year, all the machinery was installed. You could go through the top of the United States exhibit, and our history of the past, the present, and the future would happen to you. At the start of the second year, I got a phone call from the Department of Commerce saying, and of course we were all working directly under the president. We started working with President Kennedy, and we wound up working, God forbid, with President Johnson. I see I have friends here. All right. Anyway, at the start of the second year, the Department of Commerce called me and said, hey, we want to make a few changes in the United States Pavilion, especially in your big super ride upstairs. We want to make some changes to please the president. Now, what we want to do is this. We want to take out some of that stuff you put in about space travel there, and we want to put in something about the Great Society. You're way ahead of me. Well, there was a long silence on my end of the line. And finally I said, if I give you a message to give to the president direct, will you give it to him? You know, you all have dirty minds. And he said, what's the message? I said, tell him he's fired. Well, we finally did it, didn't we? Huh? Yeah, we finally did it. I can't. A year ago, I don't know if you know it, I helped to start a new group politically called Dissenting Democrats. And when I held my first press conference down in L.A. on this, all my friends said, it's no use. We'll never get rid of Johnson. Don't bother. Why bother doing this? I said, well, we got to do something. You know, we simply have to do something. So we started the group, and by God, you know, we did get rid of him. Yeah, it's kind of beautiful. Democracy works, doesn't it? Okay. That's enough of politics. We've had too much the last few weeks, haven't we? And, yeah, we'll try to make it a little happier here today. Anyway, the thing is, the happy ending to my story about the United States Pavilion is that I held firm. I said, I will not change. I said, you don't understand this generation and what the rocket ship means to them. For God's sake, when you get a metaphor, when you get a super simile that works, that represents our time, use it. Embodied in space travel with all its flaws, with all of its paradoxes, is this generation. We're looking to space travel to make many sea changes in us as a people. Look what it's doing to our religions. Look what the technologies of the world have done to our thinking and philosophy and sociology and psychology the last 10, 15 years. Now, when you get a simile like this, a metaphor like this, use it. I will not take it out of the exhibit. In fact, I want to put more about space travel in the United States Pavilion, because this is our future. This we can use to work against the factions of war. This is something I believe that can fuse the various races of the world into one race, which we all basically are. Let's not kid ourselves. And all the differences can be fused in this rocket fire if we choose to have it that way. But you got to name it, and you got to use it. You've got to be enthused about it, and you've got to write poetry about it and music about it, so that in turn some slow transformation of the political picture can occur. I won my fight. We put more space stuff, and we did not mention the Great Society. Now, if this sounds like I'm against the Great Society, not for a moment, but I believe a Great Society is pulled up under great ideas. They can be poetic, they can be romantic, they can be many things, as long as they galvanize us. Why do you imagine I ever went into writing science fiction? Because I was excited by it, because I loved it, and I've loved it all of my life. I continue to love it. I continue to work in these fields. And the moment I stop loving it, I'll stop doing it. But what we've been talking about for 15 years, haven't we, is a rebirth of idealism. Idealism is always a fantastic lie, a great myth, a kind of benevolent fraudulence that we pull on ourselves in order to get things done. We all have to romanticize. Reality is too much with us, isn't it? It's a cruel world we live in. We have to find, then, that image which makes us get the work done in spite of death, in spite of our greeds, in spite of our pettiness. Something so big we can look at it and say, damn it to hell, that's worth doing. Let's do it anyway. It may kill us, it may hurt us, but it also may grow us into a better shape. It's worth the gamble. It's worth the gamble. So that's why I've been in this field since I was 8 years old. And that's why when I was 12, the first things I wrote were sequels to Edgar Rice Burroughs. I couldn't have existed without Edgar Rice Burroughs to start with. And his creation of the planet Mars had to come before mine.
Edgar Rice Burroughs, American author best known for his stories of Tarzan, also wrote many books of science fiction.
And I followed along after an old love, and I created my own Mars. But I was inspired by a man who filled my life when I was 10, 11, 12. I beat people over the head with his books. I memorized John Carter, Warlord of Mars, so it came out my ears, and people ran screaming when they saw me coming. It has to be this kind of excitement, doesn't it, that informs all of our days and our lives, or it isn't worth staying in the world. And if I have one message to give to young writers, and I'm sure there are a lot of you here, and one doesn't want to go into it too deeply, but it is simply the fact of dedicating yourself to something that you love and doing it every day of your life.
You have been listening to author Ray Bradbury from a 1968 speech on From the Vault. Bradbury lives in Los Angeles and is celebrating his 88th birthday on August 22nd. Many happy returns of the day, Mr. Bradbury. For a copy of this program or for more information, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 800-735-0230. Welcome back to From the Vault. I'm Brian DeShazer. If you have just tuned in, we are listening to newly restored audio of the August 1968 World Science Fiction Convention held in Oakland, California. Along with Ray Bradbury was Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry. He would win a special award at the convention for his Star Trek television series that was able to address the social concerns of the day, including the war in Vietnam, racism, sexism, capitalism, and imperialism, without alerting the censors at NBC. Even so, NBC was prepared to cancel Star Trek before the beginning of the third season. Roddenberry begins this talk with the struggle he waged with NBC to continue with the third and final season of Star Trek.
As you know, we had the good fight. NBC was certain that I was behind, incidentally, NBC was certain that I was behind every fan paying them off, and there was a group from MIT that was out picketing the building, and also a group in New York, also some from here, bless MIT, bless Caltech, bless them all. And they had a whole corps of junior executives down there buttonholing all the people, saying, "Oh, listen, did Gene Roddenberry send you?" And they finally called me on it. They said, "Listen, we know you're behind it." And I said, "Well, that's very flattering, because if I could start demonstrations around the country from this desk, I'd get the hell out of science fiction and into politics." From what I've seen of politics lately, they could use a few good science fiction fans. At any rate, you all know we won the fight. And at that time, I told them that if they would put us on the air, as they were promising, on a weeknight, a decent time slot, 7:30 or 8 o'clock, why, I would commit myself to produce Star Trek for the third year, to personally produce the show as I had done at the beginning. This was my effort to use what, in fighting a network, you must use what muscle you have. They are monolithic, multi-billion-dollar corporations whose interests are not necessarily in the quality of drama. Basically, a show... The hard facts of life in television, and the one you must understand, is that a show is bought or sold. Basically, it comes down to how much toothpaste or underarm deodorant will that show sell. And basically, that is why a show is bought and why and how it is kept on the air. If a creator, a writer, were to come along and come up with a bit of significant visual literature, the finest thing that you could think of that could shape the future of our nation, help it, guide it the way it should go, the chances are you could not get it on the air, nor could you sustain it there if you kept it there, because that type of visual literature does not appeal to Aunt Maud in Peoria, or I mean nothing against any Aunt Mauds here, because I have one. But by that I mean it does not appeal to the mass audience who, when the announcer says, "I want you to run down tomorrow and buy a can of Lifeguard and not leave your family defenseless. She says, by God, I'll do that first thing. Unfortunately, science fiction fans are the lousiest audience in the world. They think, which is heresy. And this may answer a lot of your questions, why Star Trek has not done certain things that you as fans would like to see it do, or why it has not done certain things more. If we had every fan in the country wedded to us, and we're delighted and honored that so many of them are, if we had every university professor, every college graduate, every professional man in the country watching our show, and this was our audience, and it would be an audience of 7 or 8 million people, and it would be an audience that would certainly honor the makers of any show, we would go off the air after 13 episodes. It is one of the unfortunate truths of television. You can have as high as 11 or 12 million devoted fans, more people that have seen Shakespeare since the beginning, and be a failure. But at a certain time, in a certain night, you have to pass the magic number of 14 million. At any rate, you scared the hell out of the network, and they decided to keep the show on. And at that time, I was committed to then produce the show, personally oversee every aspect of it. I received then... A week later after... Oh, you did another terrible thing to the network. I must tell you this. They called me up in the middle of this and they said, God damn it, Gene, do you realize what it's costing us to answer these letters? and thanks to you and thanks to people like Ike Asimov and others, we were also getting... They couldn't ignore the letters because... They might have ignored yours and take a chance on you, but intermixed in the letters were letters from executive vice president of General Motors, people like that, you know, who buy airtime. So they couldn't take a chance. They hadn't answered them all. So you may remember the famous voice announcement that came on the first time the network's ever done it. One week they finally put it on the air. You remember Star Trek will be on next season. Well, I got a call a week later. And they call me up again, and they say, God damn it, listen, Gene. We put on the air that you're staying on the air, and so far we've received 100,000 letters thanking us. Now, will you tell them to stop? I was back there about this time, and one of the VPs got me in a car, and he says, I'm going to level with you. We've had a committee of 6 vice presidents working on this, and we thought you were guilty, but we now know it's Fred Bull. And he does share a great deal of the blame, and we're very proud and pleased with him, as with many others, of course. But we were delighted to make him the scapegoat, and the network can hate him now for a while. But at any rate, about... 10 days or 2 weeks later, I received a call at breakfast, and the network executive said, hello, Gene Baby. Well, I knew I was in trouble right then. Said, we have had a group of our statistical experts researching your audience, researching youth-oriented people, and we don't want you on a weeknight. On an early time, we have picked the best youth spot that there is. All of our research confirms it. That is, and it's great for kids, and that time is 10 o'clock Friday night. I said that no doubt this is why you had that great kiddie show, The Bell Telephone Hour, on there last year. Well, I want you to understand some of the politicking, some of the pressures that goes on. The only gun I then had was to stand by my original commitment that I would not personally produce the show unless they returned it to the weeknight time they promised. As a matter of fact, I threatened for a while to walk with the whole show. because this was the only possible muscle to say, either I don't own any General Motors or anything like that, so I had to threaten them with the one thing that I do on the show is what I might be able to personally bring to the show on a line producership level. I wasn't particularly anxious to put in a third year of 14 hours a day, 6 hours a week, but Star Trek was my baby, and I was willing to risk it if I could have a reasonable shot at a reasonable time. And we talked it over and held fast. We almost swayed them. Ultimately, they said, no, we will not do it. And I had then no option to, I could not then cave in and say, well, I'll produce it anyway, because then, from then on with the network, any threat or promise or anything I made, once you back down, you become the coward, and your muscle from them on subsequent projects and so on will never mean anything. So I had no option but then drop back to executive producer of the show. And I did find a producer, Fred Freiberger, who has produced Slattery's People, Ben Casey, has impeccable credits, an enormous love of science fiction since boyhood. He is backed up, of course, by our regular staff of Bob Justman, you all know Rick Carter, and the directors, the cameramen, Bill Tice, costumers, Matt Jeffrey, Art. So backed up by the regular staff, they are now producing Star Trek, while my function in it this year is policy administration. I limit myself to reading the scripts, commenting on them, and the runs. I foresee a good season. If we have a lucky break on the lead-in, the show that comes before us, we will, and with your help, we will be able to maintain our audience and hopefully go through a successful year and into others. But I've felt I owed it to the fans who did so much on the show to give them the inside story of what happened from the time we won the campaign till I received the Gene Baby call. Did you know that there are over a billion man hours of viewing of TV a week? It is wrong for this medium, this potent, powerful thing, television, that the choice of what goes out to these people, what affects their life, what children are being exposed to from the day they're born, that the sole judgment of what they see will be, will it or will it not sell underarm deodorant? Now, I got to tell you, the nation's in trouble with this kind of mass medium.
And that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault, marking the 40th anniversary of 1968, this week with speeches by Gene Roddenberry and Ray Bradbury from the 26th World Science Fiction Convention, or BayCon, recorded in August of 1968. The series is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. We are now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. For more information, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. This program was written by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening.